Welcome back. Our guest this week is Republican State Representative Matt Hall, investigating nursing home deaths during the pandemic. Our lead stories: the governor closes indoor bars, moves to reopen schools, and wants no high school football this fall. On the OTR panel, Kyle Malin, Lauren Gibbons, and Rick Pluta. Sit in with us as we get the inside out, Off the Record.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michigansroadtotop10.com. And now, this edition of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to a busy, busy week edition of Off the Record. You know, in the Capitol Press Corps, as we go into a holiday weekend, everybody hopes that we segue in it very quietly with nothing going on. And then all of a sudden, the fire hose was turned on yesterday with all sorts of news. And let's start with opening the schools, Lauren. The governor says, let's do it.
Yeah, and I think that goes in along with trends of what other states are saying. I think everyone is kind of ready to see what school looks like during a pandemic at this point. And I think a lot of schools in Michigan breathed a sigh of relief recently because it does appear that Governor Whitmer and the legislative leaders have reached a deal on funding for schools. But I think there are still so many unknowns. There's so many unknown factors out there about what different schools will need to do to make sure that everyone is safe. And the governor put out extensive guidelines for what that means. But I think there's still going to be a lot of trial and error here to make sure that once kids get back into the classroom, that they're going to be safe doing so.
And I think the key word in what Lauren just said is trial and error, that we don't really know exactly what's going to work and what's not going to work. And a lot of this is being left up to the schools. Like she said, it's guidance. It's not mandates. And I think that there are some school officials and a lot of parents are hoping for something that's a little bit more concrete than that. Because once you open the schools back up, there are a lot of unknowns as to exactly how it's going to work out. And you don't want to start down this road without, without some assurance that you're not going to have to shut back down again.
Well, but I think that's why the governor decided to make this a local decision. I mean, she doesn't want to have to be responsible for all of the different schools and what happens if we have a case breakout in Redford. Does that mean that the school in Saginaw should shut down? The answer is no. So that's why she's left it up to the schools to kind of create their own protocol, to decide how they want to do it. And she's also decided to wash her hands right now, for at least, on the question of high school sports. She's letting that up to the High School Sports Association to decide if we're going to have football. I mean, she's going to go ahead and make the decision to shut down bars if that's all you're doing is serving alcohol indoors. But she doesn't want to say that every community can't have their football this fall. I think that there isn't a lot of political good that comes with that, particularly when Texas and Florida were seeing exploded number of COVID-19 cases and decided to plow forward with their football seasons. She's going to go ahead and let somebody else decide if they want to go down that road. And if that becomes problematic, I'm sure she'll step in.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Kyle on one point, which is you don't necessarily want to close down schools in a different region, depending on what happens at another one. However, if there is a problem, I mean, this is where contact tracing becomes so important, that you want to know where students and extracurricular activities, to the degree that they're allowed, are going to be, because that's key in determining what's safe and where it's safe.
Well, it is clear that she gave the locals her local control piece, which they wanted, but there were also mandates in this thing. Am I not right? You're supposed to put on a mask and wear it all day long. Is that not correct, guys?
Yes, mask wearing was a big part of that proposal, as it has been in most of the governor's reopening guidelines. Technically, required, although there's no punishment. So it does remain to be seen. it would also be interesting to see, you know, once you get especially to the younger children, or if there are some concerns with, you know, younger children potentially not being, not having the concentration to be able to keep those on all day, or like might be playing with them, or, you know, just kids play a lot as well once they're younger. So it's like, how do you teach a child to keep social distancing when that's not something that they have at this point necessarily had to experience in a school setting? So there's a lot of factors, especially when it comes to younger children, that might still not necessarily quite understand exactly what the coronavirus is and what they need to do.
So what about the parents who say, my kid's not wearing a mask? What are you going to do about it?
I think it's going to be up to the local school district to determine what they want to do with that. But the bottom line is they can't really do much except maybe eventually shut down a school if they have a COVID case, which I think this is where this is going. If there's a school district that ends up having a case of a COVID-19 case, that means that that school is going to get shut down. There's going to be some kind of cleaning that's going to take at least a day or two, if not a week. And then they're going to have to resume online classes. As part of this, all these schools are going to have some type of remote learning element that is more than just keeping things going, I guess. It's got to be actual learning. It's not just sending home a worksheet and say, do this when you feel like it. Or, you know, here's a website, doodle around here. It's going to have to be some type of actual learning, because if this is something we're going to have to deal with all school year, the kids are going to have to find a way to learn, or this whole school year is going to be a wash.
Yeah, well,
it's not just the students and the parents who are going to have to figure out a way to learn, that our schools and state government is going to have to figure out a way to learn how to address this unique situation.
I think there's a huge point.
Go ahead, Lauren.
Sorry. I think it's really important to Kyle's point a little bit. There are a lot of discrepancies with what students have available in their homes, especially when it comes to internet access and being able to access all of those communications. You've seen a lot of districts already having to deal with this over the last several months, and there is, you know, now federal funding available to kind of address that, but schools really need to start thinking now. You know, there may be students that don't have access, perhaps live in a rural community or just don't have internet access at all. That is going to be the question, and that's where it's going to become really important, where, you know, having in-person classes would obviously be preferable in a situation like that. So, yes, remote learning is an option, but it's not always the best option for districts, and it's going to be crucial for especially those districts to really figure out how to safely get people back to school.
And doesn't this also raise a lot of issues in terms of disparities in infrastructure, that we're talking about all kinds of difficulties that have been sort of, kept low for a while, or low priorities? And this is going to force a conversation on all kinds of disparities across different school districts in different parts of the state.
The numbers are interesting. I saw one survey that said between 10 and 30% of the parents will not send their kids back. And there's another factor that really has not been talked about. What about all of the teachers that are going to retire and said, you know what, we're not going back. I'm going to take an early out, or I am going to move up my retirement. So you're going to have some inexperienced teachers in the classroom. It's a perfect storm for a lot of problems coming down the road. And just one other point. Isn't it good for this governor that she's not running for re-election this year, closing the bars and suggesting we have no high school football? We're in outstate Michigan. That is a cultural mess ready to happen. Am I right or wrong, guys?
The last thing we really need is an additional political element added to this. We already have politics added because we have the presidential race up in November. To have the governor up right now, I think would be an added problem that I'm kind of glad we don't have.
I think somewhat wrong.
All right, so let's talk about closing the bars. Why'd she do this, Rick?
She did it because there was one bar in East Lansing that was unable to enforce social distancing and some other safety precautions, and customers at that bar then went back to their homes. The Grosse Pointe is one of the places. And we saw the kind of spreading of the infections that could lead to a resurgence that's larger than the one that's already expected.
Well, I don't think it was just Harper's, but she was also looking at the data that there has been an uptick in cases. Remember, at one point, weeks ago, the average was about 152 cases. We're now hovering between 200 and 300 almost on a daily basis. All the deaths have not skyrocketed. But she's just concerned that this is, you know, especially on a holiday weekend where Michigan people like to go into bars. You can still go outside and drink, just not inside. Was it the right move, Lauren? Certainly controversial.
You know, it was controversial, but public health experts do say that bars are typically one of the easiest places to spread coronavirus. People are taking off their masks so they can drink. They obviously have been consuming alcohol, so they may not be quite as prudent about keeping social distancing, or, you know, maybe, you know, just congregating closer together than they would be otherwise. And so I think it is going to be really interesting. The governor did allow for establishments that do sell alcohol but are making less than 70% of their money on it to continue to stay open. So I'm interested to see exactly how many bars in Michigan this impacts. For example, if a brewery or a bar restaurant, for example, it can say, hey, you know, we've got the receipts, we sell less than 70% of alcohol, then they can still stay open. So obviously a place like Harper's, a college bar, does presumably make most of their money off of the alcohol component. So perhaps those big congregation bars will be affected. But I think there's a good chance that a lot of bars will say, hey, we're under the cutoff.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing too is the governor is now allowing drinks to go, which is a new frontier for alcohol service in Michigan. And, people can still show up outside. But this is a new challenge that, by and large, public opinion has supported the governor's restrictions to try and slow the spread of COVID-19. But we haven't really seen a situation where restrictions have been relaxed and then reimposed.
Yeah, this isn't just the case, though.
Go ahead.
This isn't just the case of a college bar, though. I mean, the governor was itching to do something about the strip joints in Detroit, too. I mean, she'd been getting some reports on the adult entertainment facilities on 8 Mile and other places in Detroit. And that was causing a little bit of conflict with her executive orders. I mean, how can you continue to have gyms closed, but we can have adult dancers getting close to patrons? And that didn't seem to make any sense either. So this executive order takes care of that problem as well.
All right, we're going to call in Representative Matt Hall in just a moment. But first, I thought at the beginning of this week, the lead story on Off the Record this week was bipartisan framework for a budget deal. And here it is. It's buried as story number 82 with all this other stuff going on. Rick, just give us 30 seconds on this historic bipartisan deal.
Well, it's a bipartisan deal on how federal dollars are going to be spent to deal with aspects of the COVID crisis. But, you know, relatively easy compared to some of the other challenges that are still awaiting them, when we've got to figure out how Michigan taxpayers are going to pay for aspects of this. The governor said that we still need more help from D.C. That's matching what we're hearing from other states that are obviously putting pressure on their congressional delegations. The governor asked the Republican leadership to do the same. So, you know, we'll see how the next chapter in this plays out.
The real bugaboo here is they have $490 million in cuts, and the administration is just really convinced that the Republicans are going to come in and want to slice and dice state services, dive into their departments and take all their money away. And it's Katie bar the door for the administration, which would like to find other ways to eliminate the 490 without cutting into state services. So now let's call in Representative Matt Hall over on the other side of the state. Representative, thanks for joining us here on Off the Record. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Tim.
Let's have Kyle give you the first one.
Hello, Representative. You are the chair of this new COVID-19 task force that the legislative leaders have tasked with taking a look at the response from the administration to this pandemic that we find ourselves in. First up on your plate was to determine what was going on with the Unemployment Insurance Agency and why people were not getting their checks when they should have been or were not able to get in contact with the agency, whether it be online or over the phone. Now, UIA experienced a 4,000% increase in the amount of claims, and they had the staff to deal with 5,000 claims. They were getting hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cases. Why isn't it just not easy enough to say there was just too much for them to handle and leave it at that?
Well, I think the biggest problem that I'm hearing about from people across my districts in Kalamazoo and Calhoun County is the lack of responsiveness from UIA. I think they have a major communication problem also. So I think people understand what you just said, that, hey, this system wasn't designed for the surge that we saw in number of claims. But, you know, people still feel I should be able to get a call back, especially almost 3 months into this. There should be a way to get a message. We hear stories from people who've uploaded their identification 5 times and still can't get information. So right now, I think there's a large communication crisis. I mean, in my office, it takes over 5 weeks to get a response when I submit a constituent, and those are for the most serious cases. And then also, I think people don't understand why 3 months in, we can't reopen the unemployment insurance offices in each region. People, even if they had to wait longer, I think would feel better knowing they have a date certain where they can resolve these issues. So there's a number of problems. And I also think they were a little slow to ask for outside help. You know, we appropriated $29 million of federal money that's kicking in. And they've told me this week they're going to have 500 new people on the phone making calls. And I'm so hopeful that that works, because we've heard so many stories from people on food stamps because of this, who've had to take out loans on their 401k. And for many people, they're still waiting 10 or 12 weeks. And that's why I thought it was important to take this issue on.
Representative, is there a quick fix to a communication problem? It does sound as though you're making the recommendation to open some of these offices to perhaps ease the backlog on the phones and email systems. But is there a quick fix to a communication problem in your mind?
Well, this problem started in March, and now we're in July. So I think they've had time to correct that. I know they've spent $20,000 on a PR crisis communications firm, an outside firm, to help with that. I asked him in committee, well, are they helping? Because we're not seeing it. And so they definitely have challenges there. And it's not just, I mean, even the media. I mean, it took me over a month to get an answer from them. How many people need benefits still? And they gave me that number. And then the next day they drastically changed it. So the numbers they're giving to me, they're very slow to give information to the media, and certainly extremely slow to give information to the public. They can't get through. They waited days and hours on the phone, it seems like. And some people are over 10, 12 weeks, and that's not good enough.
Well, should the legislature have been moved quicker to give the agency more resources to handle this? Because obviously funding is a responsibility of the legislative branch.
Yeah, I think the governor signed this yesterday, this supplemental. And so I know it was sitting there for a few days. You know, the question I keep asking the Unemployment Insurance Agency is, what can we do to help? And really, they don't give us a lot of answers. So this is what they asked for. The legislature and the governor have delivered that. So now it's on unemployment insurance agency to deliver. And they've told us they're putting all of these people on phones this week. I sure hope it works, because I will tell you, we're still getting so many calls from people who are struggling to get their benefits through no fault of their own. And that's not fair at this point.
Representative, would you favor firing some of these people, not only in that system, but in the healthcare system vis-a-vis the nursing homes, such a head's role?
One concern that I have really is, first of all, I would just say Governor Whitmer doesn't listen to the legislature that often, so I don't think she really would take my opinion on this. But I will say that changing the director right now in the middle of this, I think would probably make it worse. So I think we've got to rely on Director Gray to fix the problem. And then I think then the governor should make those determinations about what to do. But right now, when people are struggling 10 or 12 weeks to get benefits, I think if you had a huge shakeup at the top, you'd probably have them waiting even longer. And so what I've tried to do is continue to shine light on this, continue to ask questions, get information to the public, and try to hold them accountable, do the best we can with the people who are there right now.
All right, and on the nursing home situation, you've asked the governor to supply information. Has the seven-day clock run out, and are you ready to pull the trigger on a subpoena to get the communications that you want?
Well, we still have a little time today. Today is, we're taping on Thursday, so today is the deadline that we set of 7 days to give us an answer about tell us when you can answer our questions. And what my questions are very similar to what the U.S. Congress was asking for. Basically, you know, we want to know what went into these decisions. How did you make these decisions? What data were you relying on? What is the real data of nursing home deaths in our state? That's been confusing, I would say, the least. So really, we're trying to understand what were the decisions? How did these decisions be made? What are the results of those decisions? And the reason for that is that, you know, this is a pretty controversial policy. I mean, you know, when you're taking people who have COVID-19 and you're putting them in with people who don't, you're putting those employees and the people living there who are some of our most vulnerable people. You know, people over 65 are the most vulnerable people for this. And on top of that, they're, you know, not in the greatest health if they're in a nursing home usually. So they're at risk more than anyone else, but yet, you know, we put COVID patients there, and that really is hard for myself and many people to understand why they would do that. You know, there are other states.
Representative, where else would you put these patients? Would you put them back in the hospital? I mean, are you putting them back in the hospital? Are you putting them at field hospitals where they don't have the support that typically these older people have? You got to put them somewhere, right?
Yeah, I know. If you look like the nursing home lobby, the Healthcare Association of Michigan, we learned they recommended at the beginning of this to the governor that they find specific nursing homes and just designate those for COVID patients and not mix them. And that's another thing we asked for. Let's see all those communications from the nursing homes and other experts, what they provided to the governor. You guys can't get that from FOIA usually, but I think it's important to know the other options that were available, including, you know, what other states have done, which that is one of those things. They put them, I understand, into dedicated nursing homes just for people with COVID. Obviously, our field hospitals were empty. There were other options, and I want to learn more about why they didn't choose those options. And I don't think they're being transparent. They're not answering a lot of questions. You talked earlier about some things, and so it's taking months to get answers, even for the media. You know, she suspended FOIA. You know, it's still back in the day, so it's taking a long time to get answers. I think we need to know, because people's lives are at stake here. If we see another surge, we're going to need a smarter plan of action than what the governor put forward.
Representative, let's assume at the end of the day you have not gotten a response from the governor's office. It's crickets. Will you issue the subpoena, sir?
I have the power to do that, and I'm certainly willing to if we don't get an answer. But I will say the next step is going to be to try to have a conversation and to, you know, talk it through with the governor's office. My preference is to work together. My preference is to, you know, get answers from them in a way that is not hostile, because really we should all want the same thing here, which is to find a smarter plan of action to keep all of these people safe. If there's another flare up in deaths or in COVID-19 that would cause these deaths to such vulnerable people. So my goal is to get that information voluntarily. I think that the public is owed this information, but I do have the power to issue a subpoena through my committee if I need to. And I will if I have to.
Representative, do you, and does the Republican caucus in the House agree that there is going to be another surge?
I certainly hope that there's not another surge. We don't know, but I certainly know it's possible. And that's part of what this committee is designed for, is to, you know, the Joint Select Committee on the COVID-19 pandemic, to look at the decisions that were made by this administration, including this plan to put COVID positive patients in nursing homes, and to try to figure out a smarter way to do things. And then we can hopefully help, if there is another wave, do better than what.
Representative, obviously we just scratched the surface here. You've agreed to hang on for a little overtime section. Is that good with you, sir?
Yes.
Great. All right. Let's do the close credits. We'll get back with our great panel and our great guest right after that. Go to WKAR.org for OTOTR. See you there.
Production of Off the Record is made possible in part by the following. Business Leaders for Michigan has a strategic plan to make Michigan a top 10 state in the nation for jobs, personal income, and a healthy economy. Learn more at michigansroadtotop10.com. For more Off the Record, visit WKAR.org. Michigan Public Television stations have contributed to the production costs of Off the Record with Tim Skubick.